Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. So today I'm excited to welcome back onto the podcast author Lee Stein. You may remember an earlier episode where we dug into a book launch case study for our upcoming novel called Self-Care. This is a book that releases in June of this year. And last year, she and I worked together to prepare for that book launch. And in the first episode, we dug into exactly what we did, what her launch strategy looked like, why she worked with me so far ahead of launch, all that stuff. Today, we're doing a check-in, and we're looking at how she has been adjusting her marketing and launch strategy in such a radically changing world. At one point, she called it a gonzo marketing strategy, because when you change things, it means you can also show up for the things that you're excited about. So one thing we dig into here is why she started writing poetry again and sharing poetry publicly, even though poetry has nothing to do with her novel, and it's been a decade since she's last really written poetry. We talk about how she is pitching and how she's sending out every idea that she has. She has a great message here of really focusing on what she can control. As usual, she is so generous in sharing specifics about what she is doing, why she's doing it. And she and I talk about how the launch strategy and marketing that we had discussed and worked on, really how it evolved. And again, right back into the foundations of how you can consider your own marketing and book launch strategy. All right, everyone, here is my conversation with Lee Stein. Hey, everyone, this is Dan Blank, and I'm excited to be chatting again with Lee Stein. Welcome.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay, so we are doing another installment of our case study around the launch of your new novel, Self-Care. And you sent me a little email update, and I'm so curious to talk because I think since last time we spoke, we've been thrust into this global pandemic and everything about life has changed and your book launch is coming up and we've been planning a long time. And then this is like The Graduate, you know, where, you know, a lot of authors, when they're dealing with a massive disruption in their book launch plan, you said one word that's the solution to it all. And that word is poetry.
Yes.
Tell me about this.
So this is a surprising thing that happened in March. I read a book about drinking, and I decided to do like a 30-day alcohol-free experiment in early March. This was coronavirus was kind of in the news, but we hadn't yet gone on lockdown. I decided to try this experiment in early March, and 11 days later, I started writing poems again for the first time in 10 years. And it was like a miracle because I started off my career as a writer, as a poet. I was writing poems all the time. It's the first things that I got published. It's what led me to even finding a novel for my first, or finding an agent for my first novel was because she loved my poetry. So poetry was like my first love, and then I stopped writing it for years. So in the middle of this pandemic, I started producing all these poems, and it's been such a comfort to me in quarantine and kind of an exciting creative shift for me. And I started sending these poems every day to my agent and my book editor. And they were like, oh my God, these are the highlights of our days. Like they were sharing them with everyone in their office, my pandemic poems. And they were like, we have to find somewhere to publish these. So for about 3 weeks in April, I tried to find somewhere to publish the poems. I emailed different editors at different places. And I said, like, will you run a column by me of pandemic poetry? But what's happening in media right now is that advertisers aren't spending money because people aren't going out and shopping. So publications have less budget to pay freelancers. So there's chaos in media. Yeah. And I just wasn't even getting responses from these editors. And meanwhile, I'm writing these relevant poems that like two people are seeing. Like I'm sending them to my friends, but I kept thinking like these poems need to be seen somewhere. So I ended up just starting a newsletter for my own poems. Called Poet in Residence. So poetry for people in residence when we're all in residence right now. And I emailed. So part of my work with you was working on a podcast strategy, and I brainstormed all these podcasts that were relevant that might be interested in my book. One of them is a beauty podcast called Forever 35, and I had sent them a copy of my book. They started a spin-off podcast called Here For You, where every day it's the two of them talking for 30 minutes about what their lives are like in quarantine. And I sent them an email and was like, if you guys want to do a poetry episode, like I've been writing these poems in quarantine, like I'd be happy to read them for you. And they wrote back, they're like, that would be great. So I ended up appearing on this show with my poetry, and I got like 100 new subscribers to my newsletter. After that, and it's perfect because this is so the audience for my book. Anyone that would listen to their show about beauty is the audience for self-care. So this is my gonzo marketing strategy.
I love that. There's so much to unpack here. I don't know where to start, but I'll start from the end and work back to the beginning. And I'm writing down gonzo marketing strategy so it can be the headline of the podcast. So it's interesting because I've seen a couple of podcasts in other places where they've gone to daily or they've gone more frequently. And it's an interesting opportunity, actually, that you really picked up on, which is not only was it a good fit, and we'll talk about why, but these people need content. They are probably, even though they're more stressed and it's different, they're probably more open to a pitch because here they are every day having to invent a new episode, a new issue, a new something or other. Did you feel that when you were reaching out?
You know, I didn't think of that, but it also occurs to me that like I was trying these like traditional media channels that are kind of like that are losing their freelancer budget. That's what I was trying. And I wasn't trying to get paid. My goal wasn't to get paid. My goal was to share the poems. But actually to approach podcasts, I wasn't paid to be on the podcast. I mean, I did it for pleasure and for fun and to reach people. Like you just said, they are thirsty, hungry for content right now. And so that's where I hit the mark in a way that I didn't when I was trying to pitch online editors.
Well, it's funny. I was talking to a couple of writers this week about prestige of this is why I want traditional publication, or it's why I want to pitch a journal or a magazine. And it's like, I'm writing about this a lot in my newsletter, but that idea of the narrative, and there's narratives out there of, like you said, media is in chaos. Oh, it's so useless to bother pitching. But then you do that whole reframe of saying, all right, maybe that's true. But there's a million other great places where places you like, places your audience is, places that would be a great fit. And if you remove the notion of traditional prestige, whatever the heck that is, remove the notion of like, well, what's the compensation? Just say, I just want to share. It sort of opens up so much.
Yeah, and sharing is such a theme in your own newsletters, and it also connects to something that we talked about on our previous episode together, which was my whole idea for the zine. And making a zine really brought me back to being a teenager and something that I could create in my bedroom with a glue stick. And sharing poems online, I mean, I was doing this on a blog when I was like 19 years old. Like, this feels so familiar to me, and it's part of my original motivation for becoming a writer was to write a poem and have two people say like, I love your poem. Like, that's why I became a writer. And I've achieved so much in my career from that time. And yet there's something that feels so good to me about returning to this way of sharing.
Yeah. It's funny. I feel we must've talked about this previously too, but that's something that really resonates about so much how you approach this is, you know, I'm 47. So I had a zine in like 93, 94, 95. And all that stuff, like I remember just getting anyone to see what I did felt miraculous. And I love that you are reconnecting with that in a lot of different ways, because again, it's such a challenge to how many people say, it's like, oh, I have a newsletter, but only 50 subscribers. And they're so mad and jaded. And I'm like, that's awesome. Like, you know, it's like 50 people, even if like 20 of them are bots, like that's 30 people, you know, like we can do something with this.
Yeah, it's those personal relationships are so a reason of why I write. And like this, I follow this marketing expert. I don't even know if that's what he would call himself, but Paul Jarvis. I think he has 30,000 newsletter subscribers, but he talks about how part of his routine every week is to personally respond to the emails he gets. So he thinks of the newsletter as like a community, and it's part of his quote unquote job to communicate. And I've written him emails before to his newsletters, and he writes me back in a very sincere way. So I love that I can send a poem out and get a response that's like, I saw that TV show too, or like, should I watch this movie? That it's a dialogue. I find that to be really fun.
So this goes back to the personas we created, but it's a good question. So you have this novel coming out. Why go on a podcast that I think you said it's like a beauty podcast? Like, what's the deal with that? Why, if you have a good novel coming for writing poetry, why does that matter in terms of audience and all that?
Well, I'm still obsessed with the things that I'm obsessed with. So even though I'm moving between genres, I still have the same obsession. So I'm still interested in influencer culture. I'm still interested in the way the self-care industry says, take care of yourself by buying this thing. I'm still interested in the way women talk to one another online. It's interesting because in my novel is kind of political and kind of satirizes this kind of hyper woke discourse where you shame other people for not believing the correct opinion. But I'm seeing that play out with the pandemic. I'm seeing all kinds of scolding. You're not grocery shopping correctly. You're taking this away from that person. So it's the same dynamics in my novel. There's just a different controversy at the center of the drama. So my preoccupations remain the same. And I think if people like my poems, I sent a poem out today that was kind of like about skincare and about this reality show, Love is Blind, that I watched on Netflix like at the beginning of the pandemic. But I put at the bottom of the newsletter, like, if you love this poem, you might like my novel, Self-Care, which is about this. So I'm trying to find ways to promote self-care without being like every issue of my newsletter is like, by the way, I have a book. Please buy it.
Well, this is also, so we created the personas of Rachel and Lauren. And I have to imagine this goes into that too, which is that audience of that podcast, the way you're writing the podcast, your poems, they should appeal to the Rachels and the Laurens of the world.
Yes.
Can you give us a quick refresher on Rachel and Lauren?
Yeah, so Rachel is maybe an older millennial or Gen Xer. She might have kids. She reads The New Yorker when she has time. She has kind of an ironic idea of self-care, like she might drink red wine and call it self-care. And maybe she sneaks a cigarette on the weekends. Whereas Lauren is more sincere about self-care. She does a lot of yoga. She follows a lot of fitness influencers. She's really invested in self-improvement and being the best she can be. But I think I'm writing to both those audiences. You know, I think I myself am a little bit of both. Like I've been practicing a ton of yoga. I've almost been thinking to myself, like I have an idea for a personal essay about how like I started. I went into the pandemic like as Marin, as one of the characters in my novel who's like a workaholic and an alcoholic, and I'm emerging from the pandemic like the character Devin because I'm like a vegetarian who does yoga every day, and I've like really been taking care of myself and my health.
Interesting.
So even I think it's a spectrum. I think it's a spectrum, and different women fall on different parts of sections of that spectrum. But if we can kind of look at the whole industry and make fun of it, like that's who I want to sit at the lunch table with.
Well, and this is a good use of that. So, I mean, just a refresher for the listeners, you know, a persona is like a fake person that represents a segment of your audience. And the whole point is to use them as a tool of saying, hey, is it useful to do, poetry like this and share it in a beauty podcast? And instead of saying, well, is it crazy? Is it not? In that weird funnel, you just say, dude, would the Laurens listen to that? Would Rachel's listen to that? And you think of that one person of Lauren and be like, you know what? Lauren might be into it. And then the answer is, let me give it a try. It's like a tool to figure out where you can go to reach your ideal audience.
I found it to be so helpful. And I think about this idea of personas even when I'm helping, because I work as a book coach, like helping clients who are working on book proposals and thinking about the marketing of their book, because they might know what comp titles are, so they might be able to say, well, my novel is like this, or my nonfiction book is like this other one. But then I say, like, well, who do you imagine reading it? Like, who is the person? Like, what do they look like? Who's going to buy your book, and where are they going to buy it? Is it someone who goes to a library? Or because it's like we're creating in this vacuum if we don't imagine an actual human reader holding the book and opening it and reading it, because that's what we want. That's our dream, is to have those people read it. But who are the people?
Well, it's also, and not to belabor the point of personas, but the one thing that I try to do with them is the idea of getting around these fake idealized people. Because I've seen so many people, like, who are your readers? My readers go to the library and they're deep thinkers and they read this and this and this and that and they watch these documents. And it's sort of like, and I'm like, who is this person? Like, I'm not saying that isn't an aspect, but it's like, do they have any negative qualities? Do they struggle with, like, where am I finding these perfect people who go to the library and read all these books? Because most people I know, they buy the books, they intend to buy the books, but they struggle to find the time. They struggle to fall in love with the book. And when you can create a whole person, well, then it's better for marketing because it's like you said, it's like the one who, yeah, she approaches self-care, but kind of ironically. And it's like, ooh, that's a lot of people I know. Let's dig into that.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to even think about this from like a meta perspective during the pandemic, because what are we reading? I really went through a period during this where I like couldn't focus and I couldn't read anything. And so I knew all these new books were coming out, but I just thought I cannot. Then I thought like, well, I'll just buy books. I can read them later. But it's been interesting. Like my taste right now, like I read Girl on the Train, which is like, you know, a page turner bestseller that's not quote unquote like highbrow that I'd never read. And I was like, this is the perfect thing. This is exactly what I want to read right now. So it's also like an education to me about readers to kind of read things that maybe I wouldn't pick up for certain snobbish reasons. but I am like, oh, I can see why this was like a big hit because, you know, I can tell. And I like, I can't put it down either. And like, that's how I spent a couple of days of my weekend. Great.
That's a great point. It's funny. It does remind me of, I mean, I talk to so many writers, but it's that thing which is like, you know, who's their audience or what's your book like? They're like, oh, my work is... It's literary and it's blah, blah, blah. And what you find out is they don't really read. They don't really read in the market. They pull a couple comps from, you know, 20, 30 years ago, a couple big names. And that's not good or bad. That just is. That's fine. But it's the idea that if you create that kind of persona, like that perspective that like, oh, that's whatever. It's like, well, reading Girl on a Train, like, give it a shot. You might find it's not your book. But yeah, you can learn something about the readership or why was it so big or why was it so controversial or why were people over it or why were there copycats, like whatever it was. It's almost like a business thing too. You're reading it from pleasure, which is great. But it's like you can also approach it like a business. If you want to run an Italian restaurant, eat at a lot of Italian restaurants. Eat at a lot of restaurants in general because you will learn something.
Right. Yeah, there was recently like a Twitter controversy, at least in my own little tiny bubble, about Sally Rooney, whose books that I love. But there was a small journal online that published like a writer went to talk to other writers about why she's so overrated. And so then there was a big debate about whether Sally Rooney is overrated because so many people like her books. And some people were saying, like, don't read something if it's like, don't read the popular book, read the unpopular books. And I was just like, this is insane. Like, aren't we writers because we want people to read us? Isn't it good to be popular? But to be popular is in certain circles kind of denigrates your work. If your work is popular, it must not be well written.
Writers. So you were talking about with the poetry. So it started your career and you did it because you loved it. Forgive me if this gets personal, but is there a reason that you sort of stopped? Was it just, oh, I got into something else? Or was there a real block? Was it symbolic? Or was it like, I don't know?
Well, I told myself that I was going to write a quote unquote real book. And that was my first novel. So I deliberately shifted from writing poetry to writing prose. And then I kept writing prose. Then I wrote a memoir. Then I wrote a second novel. But it felt, and so that's how I explained it to myself that whole time. I said, like, well, I made a decision. I made a choice. I switched. But I really think now it's like I lost this kind of creativity. Like, I'm a very productive writer. Obviously, I've written 4 books. Like, I can produce. I'm very organized and methodical and disciplined, and I have all those strengths, but it's almost like I lost the creative part, and that's what the poetry comes from. It feels like a different process. It doesn't feel like sitting down to produce. It feels more like listening to the muse, which sounds really corny, but it is a more creative practice, and it's more like I would imagine, I don't write music, but I would imagine it's more like music in that I hear it or I listen to it and I know it's finished when it sounds finished. It's more like auditory for me.
Yeah, it's interesting that when people have a break with something like that and then when it comes back. And you kind of seem to tie it to giving up drinking or the pandemic, but was it really tied to one of those or was that a coincidence or?
I think so. I mean, it's shocking to me, but I'm just starting to talk and write about the drinking and the sobriety thing. And I feel like I should preface it by saying like, I wasn't a binge drinker. I wasn't a heavy drinker, but it was something that I struggled with that I wanted to do less of. And I kept struggling with it, in therapy and I would try to cut back and it would be successful. And then I wasn't successful and I was frustrated with myself. And so when I finally stopped, it's almost like I cleared a space in my brain.
Wow.
For the poetry to come in, because I didn't have to think every day, am I going to have one glass of wine? Am I going to have two? Am I going to have zero? Am I going to have two tomorrow? Am I going to do this on the weekend? I was like, I was constantly calculating.
Yeah.
And now I don't have to do that every day. And it's like I got all this brain space back that used to be devoted to that.
Do you think the pandemic changed it too? And I'm having this conversation with a lot of people too, where of course the first thing is empathy and the crisis and all that. But being home, there's this duality a lot of people are telling me, which is like, one, it's actually kind of interesting to just not have the choice anymore. I can't go to Target. I can't go here. I mean, they're choosing not to. And it does sort of change things, which is like, you're forced to embrace. And I always think about this way. My house is built in 1910, that we're basically living back in 1910 again.
Mm.
And being forced where I can't, for all intents and purposes, I can't choose, like, we're not going out. And it sort of is interesting. I can know I'm not like, oh, I don't go out. I'm such a loser. It's like, I don't go out because there's a pandemic. So it's like forces me into this other thing. Is any part of that, do you think, did that affect it or?
I don't know, but I am interested in the idea of like, how constraints can breed creativity. You know,
that's a better way to put it.
But poets who write formal poetry, I don't write formal poetry, but like a sonnet, like following the rules of a sonnet, I know for some poets, like that's where they can be creative because they have a rule or a structure. But something that's also been, I think, inspiring for my work is just there's such an onslaught of information right now. You know, I check the news, I watch CNN, I'm on all multiple websites, but I'm also watching TV at night. So like all my inputs, including the news from the New York Times, but also including like stupid reality TV so I can shut my brain off for an hour, like all of that can go in the poems because I think that's what a lot of people are experiencing right now. We can't be attuned to the devastating news 24 hours a day. We have to take breaks, but maybe we feel guilty for taking breaks. So we have all these mixed emotions.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in writing about that.
So we talked about this earlier, but, you know, when we were working together last year, putting together the marketing strategy, you know, one of the campaigns, one of the ideas was these in-person events that you were planning. And then everything changed. So how have you been processing that and maybe even adjusting it? Is it just canceled? Is it evolved?
Yeah, earlier this year, I was talking to my publisher. They were going to send me maybe to one city, and they were saying, should we send you to Chicago, which is where I'm from, or LA? And I was saying, please send me to LA, because LA is like the epicenter of the wellness industry, and I have people out there that I know from my work on BinderCon. Please send me to LA. Then, of course, the pandemic happened. So I'm not going anywhere, but I am still interested in events. And what I decided to do was to see what other people are doing, because I'm in the lucky position that my book comes out June 30th. So I'm not one of the people with a book coming out the first week of April, because they were really in a position where it was too late to reschedule what they were doing or replan, you know. Mm-hmm. So I went to one online event for a book launch to see what they would do. And it was just, they just did exactly what they would have done in person. So it was the author reading from her book and then speaking in conversation with a moderator. And you couldn't see anyone else's faces on the screen. And so if she made a joke, you couldn't hear any laughter. And I felt kind of sorry for her. And then by the end of it, so then we would be in the chat. So by the end of it, we were typing, LOL, ha 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 ha, or applause, applause, applause. So that was kind of cute that people were chatting. But I thought this doesn't really work. Like just taking something that would work in real life and just making it on Zoom doesn't exactly translate. So I've been trying to think what would be more dynamic. So I'm planning some online events, but they aren't with other writers. They're more with, one of them is going to be with like a yoga teacher, Instagram influencer, wellness skeptic. So that'll be like a wellness themed conversation. Then I'm going to do another one that's all about online culture with like four other people. So it'll be like a very dynamic, almost a panel discussion. Mm-hmm. But for both of these, I'm imagining like, how do we get the audience in on it? This week, I went to a online event for My Brilliant Friend, the TV show hosted by Europa, which is the publisher of the Elena Ferrante novels. And they didn't turn off the ability to view everyone on the chat. So there were 700 people and you could see all their little faces. And I really enjoyed that, like seeing all these different people who love My Brilliant Friend as much as I do. And the chat was insane because there were so many of us, there were like so many people chatting. But I kind of liked the spirit of being able to see everyone.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's like, as you think of like why go anywhere? You think of all these events and like, I mean, I've seen this often on the podcast recently, but like, I'm an introvert, I'm a germaphobe, all this kind of stuff. So like, I've been to a lot, but the last couple of years, especially as we had our second kid, I've not gone to a lot of places. Because it's such a pain. It's like, I'm thinking of Creative Mornings, which is run in New York City, where I've been, and it's amazing. But you've got to, like, get the ticket, you've got to show up early, you've got to be a part of a crowd, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, why bother, especially nowadays, as most of these things, they'll release it on video after. And there's a reason. It's as you're saying, it's the other people, it's the energy, it's the sense I was there, or even it's the opportunity to like leave that LOL or something where it's like, I was a part of it. You know, when Mick Jagger turned, he looked at me, I swear. You know, it's like Right. That lasts a lifetime. It's like you're a part of something.
Yeah, at the My Brilliant Friend one, I even saw in the chat one of my students was there too, and I didn't know she was going, but then she chatted me later, like, it was fun to see you there, and I was like, it was fun to see you too. Like, I saw her name.
Love that. But
it's interesting too, the other thing I'm thinking or worried about is Zoom fatigue, because I know I have it, or I've had it, I'm a little better now, but like the first few weeks of quarantine when everything was a Zoom, I was like, this is too much. This is too much socializing. I actually felt like I can't be this extroverted and do so many Zooms. So I'm also curious, by June, July, when my book comes out, are people going to be so over going to a Zoom event? You know, are they going to be outside looking at the stars, having a drink? I don't know.
It's funny. It's a good question. I obviously no one knows the answer, but I do think it's almost like anything else, which is restaurants or concerts, like everything is so crowded, and it just is that reminder of, you're right, it's crowded, so you better make it extraordinary, and you better give people a reason to show up. And it should be, and it's like, you know, like,
I'm gonna write that down.
And it should be, as you use the word gonzo, but it's like, you know, wacky marketing is oftentimes good marketing if it touches someone in some way. So it's that reminder, which is, don't be boring, don't be vanilla. Or even as you said, the first one you went to, it sounded a bit like you're a little let down, where it's like, oh, okay, they did the same thing online you do in person, and it fell flat. And of course they were the first one out of the gate, so they have to learn that lesson. But that's a good reminder, I think, as I think about it, like, yeah, you're right, maybe there is, so we better make it cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's thinking like, what would people actually want to see? Another event I went to that was really well attended was like a literary agent panel of literary agents talking about what it's like right now to try to sell books. And that was really well attended and a really well done panel. So it's thinking like, what are people interested in right now?
Well, I was going to ask you about that. In your newsletter recently, you've featured some agents, and one was, I think, from that panel. And it's something that I feel like we've talked about where, you know, a fair number of people who follow you because you're a published author and you know a lot of people. And I often find that a lot of writers follow someone like you because what they want to know is like, okay, how can I do that? So have you thought about that of, I'm featuring agents because I know that people want that and everyone's trying to get over that hurdle, or is it just random?
This is actually really interesting, and it connects to my poetry newsletter because I have this strong I have been doing the Sunday newsletter for almost 3 years. It feeds into my work as a book coach and a writing teacher, so I can promote those parts of what I do for a living in the Sunday newsletter. But I know who the Sunday newsletter audience is, and it's mostly women who are older than me writing memoirs. And a lot of those women have taken my classes multiple times. I love these women. They always reply to my emails. It's a really strong community, but they aren't a Rachel or a Lauren. So they aren't the persona for self-care. So I can promote self-care to them, and a lot of them are pre-ordering the book. You know, they're totally supporting me. But when we draw out that map of those personas, they would be someone totally different. And so another thing that my new newsletter, my poetry newsletter does, and that I reached through this podcast appearance I was on, is that I'm reaching the Rachels and the Laurens who aren't necessarily writers. It doesn't matter if they're writers. So it's a totally different audience. And we talked about this on the last podcast too, that I came to you and I said, I want to reach people who aren't writers. Yeah. Because I already reach those people. So in my mind, there's an even clearer distinction between the content I'm putting out on Sundays, which is for writers. Is it relevant to writers? And my poems, which are about wellness or cleaning my house or what I'm watching on TV.
And I love how you didn't feel you had to make a choice of one or the other, which is, I've got to reject the writing audience or not. And also, it doesn't feel like it's laborious. It's not like you're saying, now, Dan, I have to do twice as much work to keep two audiences happy. It feels like they're just pulling from different parts of who you are and what you love.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's interesting because, like, I can see, you know, my Sunday newsletter is MailChimp, so on the back end, I can see who's clicking what. And it's like, you know, I'll write something about publishing, and then I'll say something about my poems, and everyone clicks the publishing link. But that's what they're there for. They're there for my advice, my writing and publishing advice. That's what they want to meet these agents. They want to know what the agents are looking for. They want to know how to improve their submissions. That's what they're there for. So acknowledging that is not any kind of loss. It's just clarifying what I'm doing for each audience.
So has anything else changed in terms of how you've had to view the book launch, whether specific tactic or not, given how it's funny because it's not just the world has changed. It keeps changing.
Right. It keeps changing. Yeah, it's like very hard to look at the big picture of my own book launch because it's so, I don't know. One of the people I was emailing to do an event with me in early July, I said, like, does this date work for you? And of course, it's 2 months in the future. And she said something like, well, like, if we're all alive then. And I said, like,
that's what you want to hear.
I said, I agree. We should only do it if we're both alive.
Confirmed if we're both here.
Yeah. So it feels a little, I mean, am I being even presumptuous to plan an online event? But I have to, I have no choice, right? So all I can do is stay focused on what I can control. I can control who am I following up with. You know, a lot of copies of my book went out in January. Did all those people get the books? Are they going to do anything with the books? I can plan virtual events. I can direct my audience to order my book from an independent bookseller, because the other thing that's happening that's so interesting is that Amazon doesn't count books as essential. So Amazon isn't sending out books at the moment. If you order a book from Amazon, it's going to be weeks before you get it. So there's reason more than ever to support local bookstores. Bookshop.org just came out at the perfect moment, which is great because for people who don't know what that is, it allows you to order online instead of from Amazon, and the proceeds go to benefit independent booksellers. So there's some really interesting things happening. And I'm doing whatever I can. I'm pitching tons of essays. This is interesting. So I'm pitching, not only am I writing more poems, but I'm having all these ideas. So I'm pitching essays constantly. I'm getting nowhere. I think in a former life, I would have been really frustrated, but I don't feel frustrated. I just feel like all I can do is keep sending stuff out. In April, I sent out 14 pitches. Mm. I got 4 no's and 10 non-responses.
Wow.
And for people listening, I think some people at home think, you know, like, oh, Lee Stein's like a quote unquote real writer. Like, wouldn't editors at least respond to her? No, not necessarily.
Is that unusual for you?
That's a good question. Yeah, I've never pitched so many ideas at a time, but I think usually if I follow up, I at least get a no thank you.
Yeah.
But I'm not even getting, I mean, this is partly the media landscape right now, how crazy it is.
This is just speculation, but like, do you have a sense of why that might be?
Why which part?
That you wouldn't get a response.
I think the editors are their budgets are being cut and they're overwhelmed. That's my sense. And they're getting laid off. There's tons of layoffs. There's furloughs. I got one note that was like, we don't have the money for this. I got a close call like yesterday, and she said, the editor said, I'm going to find out my budget next week and I'll get back to you. Like if she can even have a freelancer write for her. Mm-hmm. So that's the state of affairs right now. But this is standard practice, right? That I, as someone with a book coming out, I'm supposed to be pitching essays that are relevant to my book, and I'm doing that. And I'm doing everything I can. I'm sending out every idea I have, and then I'm just waiting to see like what spaghetti sticks on the wall.
I love that. Sending out every idea I have.
But I think one thing that I'm doing differently that I wouldn't have as a younger writer is if something doesn't work, I'm letting it go. So I'm not trying the same idea over and over and over and over. Like there were some things that I sent out in early April that I look at them now and I'm like, this wasn't quite good enough. Like It might be me. It might not just be the editors. It might be my idea. I can see that in a way that I don't think I would have as a less experienced writer. So I'm sending out more ideas. I'm not sending out the same idea to 15 places.
That's a huge insight. And it's interesting that, you know, you chalk it up to experience. And I was thinking about that for me, where I've had a weekly newsletter for 15 years. I've got the weekly podcast. I've whatever thousands of social media tweets and stuff, where I always look at it as like, I'm just always in that creation mode that I just put stuff out there constantly and I'm always on to the next thing. I forget to, people are like, how many listeners do you have or how'd that do? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm always working on the next thing. I don't think about how the last thing did. But it is interesting because I've seen people get really crumpled up with that. They're so proud of their work and they should be. And it's hard to feel like a failure, which unfortunately people do, or to feel like you are taking work you're proud of and you worked on and just like flushing it. Yet, and I agree with you, that's a big part of the creative process is being able to keep creating, keep pitching, keep putting it out there.
Yeah. And I think I see this so often too as a book coach with my clients, but it's like you get so attached to your precious idea and your precious work that you know that you've polished and that you know is like well-written and beautiful. But once you get into the marketplace of ideas and you, whether that's trying to get a book published or trying to get an essay published, timing is so important in a way that it wasn't before when you were creating it. And so you might have a good idea at the wrong moment. And so that's what I keep thinking about pitching. Like I have to find the right idea for the right moment to the right editor. Like all the stars have to align. And I know I'll get there if I keep trying, but I think trying my old ideas, I can tell that there's something broken there.
So what you just said is like a total obsession of mine. And it's why I look at so many people's stories, whether they're writers or musicians or performers, about how they got their break or how they made it or the album that went. 10 times out of 10, it is what you just said. It's a bizarre story of they pitched it everywhere, no one gave the time of day, and then they went to this restaurant, and wouldn't you know it, two tables over was an old friend, and a table over from them was a producer, and it's like the most random thing in the universe. And that created like a household name or the biggest movie of all time. And it's just terrifying to hear as a creator. Yet that is always a part of what it means to connect with people or to find success. And it's kind of cool to hear you talk about that as someone who's like in it, you're in launch mode, you're putting stuff out there. And it's something I'm hearing from you a lot, which is like, this is just the work I'm doing.
And yeah, it's like that Woody Allen quote that's like 90% of life is showing up or something. I can't remember what percentage it is.
Yeah.
But what you just described, and for the writer, the showing up is the submitting. Because if you have a precious, treasured idea that you just keep inside and you don't even send it out, you're definitely not going to get it accepted anywhere. So the work yes. is just sending it out and sending it out and sending it out.
Totally.
And then pivoting to something else. Knowing when to pivot. I think that's the thing that really has taken me a long time to learn, is knowing when to pivot. I think I'm getting better at that.
Yeah, that's a really good point too. And I have to imagine that part of that is, and this is another annoying answer too, but tell me if I'm at least in the right direction, like it's going with your gut.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going with my gut. I think it's like a lack of attachment. I'm not precious about my ideas. Like I don't keep, I think before I would be like, that was a really good idea. That stupid editor didn't see what a genius I am to have that really good idea. I think now I can be like, yeah, it didn't work. What else have I got? How else could I approach this?
I have to imagine it also keeps you from either burning bridges or not digging in the same hole twice. I'm not even sure that's an actual metaphor. But that kind of thing, if you feel like, oh, they rejected me, whatever. I mean, I guess I'm not for them and blah, blah, blah. And you never submit to that editor again. And it sounds like with your way, it's like, didn't work. And in a couple weeks or months, yeah, you'll send them something else. No big deal.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, there's like fewer and fewer, you know, there's like, I mean, the playing field is really like, those relationships, even if they aren't relationships, even if it's just like a cordial email, yeah. It's crucial that I stay on their radar and that I try again.
I love that. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that we should be for sort of checking in on what you've been working on, what you're seeing, where the book launch is, all of that?
Well, I think the other thing that's happened since we last talked is I got a starred review in Publishers Weekly,
Yay.
Which was my first ever starred review. So it was very exciting to see that. So Publishers Weekly is like a trade magazine. So that's like an early review for the industry. But I also got good reviews in Kirkus and Booklist, which is for libraries. So it's exciting to see strangers responding to my book. And I'm seeing some booksellers also write little reviews that the marketing team has shared with me. Mm-hmm. And so that's like a really exciting part to see other people describe the book.
Ooh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's funny, that moment too. And it's a good reminder to people. And I mean, we talked about this at length because we worked together so long before so early compared to the launch, but there's so much you can do ahead of launch. I think a lot of people view it as, okay, on June 30th, I can start getting feedback. And it's like, people still exist. And you know, like you can be sending it to them there, even if they're not reviewers. I mean, I was talking to Jen Loudon last week, and you know, she had a launch team of like a couple hundred people, and they all got, you know, she's sending them either copies of the book or excerpts or whatever it is. It's like, you are working on this well ahead of launch.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other weird thing, is that my publisher, they've stopped being in their offices since March or April, so they can no longer send out physical copies.
Yeah.
So I've been sending them from my house. Like whoever wants a copy, I'm like, well, I'll just mail it. I mean, I'll just go to the post office. I've been going to the post office wearing a mask, of course, to send out these review copies that would normally come from Penguin's office because they aren't physically sending out review copies.
Yep. Yeah.
The new normal.
Yeah. And of course, I have another author doing that. And then I have authors I'm working with were like, well, there's no physical books because their timing is just off with it. The way everything
right.
affected.
Right.
All right, Lee, thank you for the check-in and sharing all of this.
Thank you.
It's funny because I was so excited to like do installments of the series, but now it's kind of cool. It's sort of like, I feel like every time we talk, it's a cliffhanger because we don't know
right.
4 or 6 weeks, whatever it is, we get closer to launch date, like when that next time to chat is and like what we're going to see.
Yeah, we have no, like, I just keep telling myself the only thing I know is that it's going to be different. Like 2 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, all I know is that it's going to be different from now, but I don't know how it will be different.
That's a powerful way to look at it. Well, thank you so much for sharing with such openness.
Thank you, Dan.
You can find Lee Stein at leestein.com. That's S-T-E-I-N. Her new book, Self-Care, a Novel, will be out in June. You can find it wherever books are sold. On Instagram, she is Lee Stein, and on Twitter, she is Rhymes with B. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me on social media at Dan Blank and on my website, wegrowmedia.com. Thank you so much for listening until the end.